This segment of the Radio Zine features an interview with Robert Hicks, author of The Widow of the South, a Civil War novel based on the story of a woman whose home became a military cemetery.
My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Robert Hicks. Can I call you Robert, or is
sure
it Bob?
Can.
Or
you can call me Robert.
Robert, good. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
The title of your novel is The Widow of the South.
Yes, sir.
I read an article about you in the New York Times, which you were discussing before we started recording the interview.
Yes, sir.
And you have quite a little personal history, but and that's sort of where I want to start with this before we get into the book per se.
Good
because,
enough.
Huh?
Good enough.
Okay. First, I'm going to ask you like a really abstracted question here, and if you don't know, just make something up, okay?
Okay. Yeah. I'm a Southerner. I can do that.
That's right, yes. The Civil War.
Yes,
or the War of Northern Aggression.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
The recent unpleasantness.
Why does it continue to grip us the way it does? I mean, I used to live in Virginia, and they can't do anything without three-cornered hats and fife and drums. But Civil War is a different thing.
I think several answers. Walt Whitman said that the Civil War was the defining point in American history. Now, this is the 16th city I've been to on this book tour, and I think he's wrong. After traveling around, I think it's the redefining point. It's where we stop using a little U on United States. It's where we stop being Californians and Floridians and Ohioans and Tennesseans and become Americans. It's where we redefine citizenship and individuality and obviously freedom. And even though we may not have worked all these things out, it's still that redefining moment. It's not important to you, or shouldn't be, because your ancestors fought for the Union or fought for the Confederacy. It should be important to you if your family came over as enslaved. It should be important to you if you came over last year from Nicaragua. Because the truth is, if you're throwing your lot with this nation, then the Civil War is a huge amount of your patrimony. It's why you are going to be allowed to be who you want. And I'm not a neo-Confederate. But at the same time, I'm at least smart enough to understand that this is our nation's collective shared history.
Well, Mark Twain, who was a bit of an expert on the subject of the South,
right,
said that race is the defining dilemma of our
Absolutely.
Culture. And although there was a lot of political issues, you know, states' rights versus federalism, blah, 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 it really was about race, or at least the aftermath
Absolutely.
Of the war is about race.
Well, I think it was. I mean, even the, you know, my neo-Confederate friends will say, it's not about slavery, it's about states' rights. And I go, and what was our number one state right? Oh, yeah, the right to own slaves.
Our peculiar institution.
Yeah. So, of course, ultimately it is. We can try to redefine it. But out of that issue of it wasn't. I think I'll say one thing. I think for the North, there are very few people in the North that fought over the issue of slavery. But in the South, whether they ever owned slaves or not, and that's kind of used by the revisionist writers to point out that so few of the Southerners that fought owned slaves. But whether they owned slaves or not, the politicians that were driving the South into secession were driving it over the peculiar institution. That's just the facts. And I think, you know, it'd be much easier as a Northerner to say the Civil War wasn't about slavery, because I think for the overwhelming majority it never was. It was that obsession that Lincoln had about the Union. And God bless him. I mean, you know, what would the 20th century, the early 20th century, been without the being an American century? I mean, first, I would probably be speaking German right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Union was important. And the preservation of it really was important. But yes, I mean, slavery ultimately was the driving force behind the South's secession. That said, at the end of it all, there are 620,000 dead boys. At the end of it all, you have probably a million people that have shortened, painful, affirmed lives because of injuries. There's nothing like it in our nation's history. Nothing ever has come close, hopefully, God help us, nothing ever will.
And also is one of the first of the so-called modern wars. I mean, there were still cavalry charges, and, you know, the infantry is still there. But the first modern weapons and tactics were used in the Civil War.
You know your homework. You're exactly right. It is the first modern war, and it also, in many ways, is the last really medieval war. I mean, both are going on because it's like half of one and half of the other. The battle at Franklin that my book's about is, in fact, probably the last really great medieval war in the world, at least in the Western world. It takes place with two full orchestras. It takes place with, you know, with the longest charge in open field in our nation's history. It is truly, truly the end of an era of warfare going back probably like almost 2,000 years.
Yeah, that, of course, leads to my next question, which is, or I guess something I want you to comment on. Franklin, you know, most people know about Gettysburg, okay?
Right.
If you know a little more, you might know about Chancellorsville and Chickamauga and First Manassas and Second. I mean, that's if you know a little more. I had actually not heard of the Battle of Franklin.
Well, welcome to the club that includes a lot of people in Franklin. So you're exactly right. I mean, you know, welcome to that club. You know, the truth is we are right now in Franklin. I'm going to go backwards on this answer. Right now we're carrying on the largest battle for reclamation in North American history, period. According to the American Battlefield Protection Program, I've just been subpoenaed by Congress to come and talk on it. No community in America has, in Virginia or Maryland, the states you think of, has ever raised, let's say, $4 million without state or federal help for preservation of historic open space when it's battlefield. No community in Virginia or Maryland has ever raised $3 million. I don't know if any communities raised $2 million. In Franklin, by this November 30th, which will be the 141st anniversary, a group I put together called Franklin's Charge will have raised within the community almost $6 million for battlefield reclamation. That said, it is, as the National Geographic in April called it, the most undeservedly forgotten battle in our nation's history of warfare. It was a battle that was crucial to basically why I didn't have to get a visa to come here. And yet, it is a battle that was almost completely forgotten.
I would have let you cross the border. But generally, I wouldn't work as a border guard, so
exactly.
Who knows?
So, yeah.
So why your interest in this?
I moved to Franklin in 1974 to pursue working in music publishing in Nashville. And I moved to Franklin because it was, you know, 20 minutes from my office in Nashville, and it was rural, and it was a small Williamson County, where Franklin's the seat of, was a small, basically southern town. I knew about the Battle of Franklin. I'd vaguely read about it, but just probably... You probably know more about it now than I knew at the time, and I was put on the board of sit on the board of a small house museum. It's like every little southern town's antebellum house museum. The director was being paid $5,000 a year. They had a one piece of furniture, had a lot of ghost stories, but the one thing it did have is it had one of the largest private military cemeteries in America, and so I sat on this. I went to this museum. Sat on the board, and it's just my nature. I wanted to learn more. As I learned more about it, I became incredibly intrigued about both the mistress of this house, Carrie McGavick, and what happened in the house on the night of November 30th, 1864, and the days that followed. And then more and more about the Battle of Franklin. Let me just, to explain the Battle of Franklin, the best way I can explain it is it's like seeing the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. But in this version, the screen goes black, the lights come on, you go home, the support ships go back to England. There will be more casualties in those 5 hours at Franklin, very brief battle. There will be more casualties in those 5 hours than there will be in the 19 hours of D-Day. That's the staggering figure. I mean, Antietam, Gettysburg, Vicksburg, they all have many, many more times deaths and wounded. But Franklin, in just 5 hours, will have some of the bloodiest fighting in our nation's history.
I've heard. I don't know if it's true that the blood came up to the shoe tops in some battlefields.
I mean, I literally, I literally ran this by historians. And there's like about 12 pages of author's notes in the back, and it was I said, did it run like rivers of blood? They said, no, rivulets of blood. This is how people, there were streams of blood across the battlefield, and it literally came up to their to the shoe tops, you know. And it was staggering. You know, you had more American generals killed, captured, or wounded at Franklin than any other engagement in our nation's history. You know, it's just the whole scene must have been like the worst horror film in history.
Yeah, except it was for real. And the thing about it is, it's one of the things we know about in Western culture is the charge of the Light Brigade. And right. And the poem said someone had blundered. And because they sent basically foot soldiers and cavalry into the teeth of cannon.
Right.
The same thing pretty much happened in...
Absolutely. Hood, the southern general, wakes up the morning of November 30th to his worst nightmare. He has a fortified town of Franklin that the Union has occupied for the last year and a half that has now been refortified by 25,000 troops. And each of his generals try to tell him not to hit it. And he decides to basically ignore their judgment. And he starts the battle about 4 o'clock, and it'll be the longest charge. As I said, it is amazing. Ed Barrs, the Dean of American Historians, says that often the charge at Franklin is called the Pickett's Charge of Tennessee. And he said, how can you possibly define something by something that's only half as big? And because basically Pickett's charge is half the men, half the length. This is. And so he says that Franklin should be that Gettysburg Pickett's charge should be called the Franklin's charge of Pennsylvania. That's his theory. But anyway, you have this, and then you have this vulnerable woman who, you know, it's the old real estate axiom: location, location, location. Finds herself right there in the middle of the battle, you know, with her house on the edge of the battlefield, and her house becomes a field hospital.
Yeah, we're going to get into that right now, as a matter of fact. But first, I have to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Robert Hicks. Robert is the author of The Widow of the South, published by Warner Books. Carrie McGavick is the mistress of Carnton.
Right.
Carnton is a real place.
Carnton's a very real place. It was named after her husband's grandfather's birthplace in Ireland, called Carntown, a house that still stands, which was called that because it was like because of the cairns, the stone piles. The floor of the house actually is still basically grave markers, and it was a house built in the middle of a cemetery, and so it was the city of the dead. And so it was the name of that house. And so they came to America. And in the 1790s, they get this plantation when Tennessee is a real wilderness. And they named the house Carnton, the city of the dead, which I guess it became.
Yeah. She was originally from Louisiana. The real Carrie McGavick.
Real Carrie McGavick.
As a young girl from Louisiana, she was courted by a cousin. John McGavick was a cousin.
You know, this is a southern story.
Esther Lee Lewis.
You know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so you know, if they're not good enough for us, they're not good enough for anyone. So she marries her first cousin once removed. Her grandfather is Felix Grundy. He is the Karl Rove of the 19th century. He is hated by the Whig Republicans in his reformation of the Democratic Party, as the Democrats now hate Karl Rove. He is a Karl Rove really for three administrations: Jackson, Martin Van Buren, and James K. Polk. And so he's this powerful behind the scenes kind of guy, and gives her a lot of her own personal strength. She marries her cousin. She moves to his plantation. And then the whole world starts to collapse around her, and the death of three of her five children.
Yes, and as a result, I don't know if this is true, but given your penchant for research, I'm guessing it is, that she wore black all the time.
Wore black, you know, from the point she was about 17, you know, she became known for this. Before it was even fashionable, and she wasn't from Manhattan, and yet she was, you know, she was always, you know, pib, people in black. And she had this sense that everyone around her kind of died, I think.
There are two photographs, or two portraits of her. One is a painting, one I think is a photograph.
Right.
The older one is a proper Victorian lady of some age, with a I don't know what to say about her, the look on her face. I mean, she's sitting for a photograph, so it wasn't very comfortable to do anyway. But there's a kind of a thousand-yard sadness in her eyes. Her eyes seem to go forever and ever. Whereas the painting of her as a young girl of, what, 17, 18 years old?
17, 18 years old. Full of
gorgeous,
promise.
Gorgeous, young, pretty young girl with, as you say, full of promise. You can see intelligence in the eyes and in the painting.
She's interesting. That painting was done by Washington Cooper. She was staying with her grandparents up in Nashville from Louisiana, obviously, and she within days, Washington Cooper, who's one of those kind of society artists of the time, actually a pretty good artist, but is kind of relinquished any kind of career over doing social portraits. He's writing her mother in Louisiana. He's saying, "Dear Mrs. Winder, we're at an impasse. Carrie is insisting on being painted in black. As she's still intact, totally inappropriate, please advise." And my favorite is her mother. It's just this great. You can just see her mother down in Terrebonne Parish, Louisiana, writes him back, and she says, "Dear Mr. Cooper, for 17 years I've tried to guide my daughter in godly and appropriate behavior. I sent her to Nashville with, I've forgotten, it was like 13 or 14 dresses. Good luck." You know, I mean, she knew how strong-willed her daughter was. And as I say, she's just getting her photo op ready for being known as the Widow of the South.
Now, when you have a battle of the scope and magnitude of Franklin, you're going to have casualties.
Right.
You're going to have wounded and dead, lots and lots of both.
Exactly.
And as you said, they her place was nearby. It was copious and spacious.
Right.
There was ground surrounding it so that they could not only house the worst cases inside the house, but they could house some of the not so badly wounded on the grounds.
Right.
And the Union Army basically turns her place into a hospital.
No, the Confederate
Army. Oh, I'm sorry, the Confederate Army, yes. The Union Army comes later, yes.
Union Army comes later. What happens is the Union takes their dying, and actually when they retreat after the battle, after basically the Confederate Army's been slaughtered, rather than fight another day, the Union Army just during the night retreats, and they take most of their wounded. There were some wounded left, but as many as they could get, they took off. But the Confederates basically made almost every building in Franklin a hospital, but her house being one of the largest and being right where it was, it becomes really the as it's often called by both Northern and Southern veterans after the war, it becomes the morgue of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. And she discovers her calling in a way.
In a very real way, because unlike her three children that had died, some of these boys didn't die. You know, we always talk about, you know, obviously the story is about all these boys that died, but her transformation is in the fact that some of them didn't die, that she was not a harbinger of death, that people could survive her and knowing her, and it became her life. My dad once said that good writing is about transformation, how the characters are transformed by their circumstances, by the events, or by each other. And ultimately, if it is good writing, then ultimately how we're transformed about in reading it. And I think that whether I succeeded at good writing, her story is a story of real transformation.
Well, you certainly have produced a gripping book. So, this is not the stuff I normally read, especially the Civil War. Which I have to admit, I'm not a great devotee of Civil War stories, and yet, you know, this book had me all the way through. Let's talk about Moriah. If I have one criticism of your writing, Moriah seems almost too good to be true.
But you know what? It's my prejudice. I think she is almost too good to be true. I mean, that's no one said that before. But you know what? I'll plead guilty. I mean, she is one of those characters, as I say in my author's notes, that is the most complete person in the book. I mean, I think that she transcended herself and her circumstances as well as anyone in this world. I also based her a bit on...
Well, tell us who she is, first of all. We haven't identified her yet.
Okay, Moriah Reddick Odie Reddick is a African-American woman born enslaved. She's not very African-American. She's half
Creole.
White, quarter black and quarter Native American. And she's an incredibly beautiful woman. The picture at the end of the book is in her 70s, and she looks like she's just had work done or something. You know, she didn't have a wrinkle the day she died.
No Botox in those days.
Yeah, no. And I mean, you know, it's just natural. I mean, she had just good genes. But she always seemed, by all accounts, I knew two of her grandchildren, but one lived to be 99 and the other one lived to be 103.
Was she like a family legend, or?
They knew her, and those people who knew her that talked about her serenity, talked about her inability to be caught up in anything. She literally walked through life, all circumstances of life. At the end of her life, Carrie had been dead about 16 years when she died. Mariah was pulled out by some reporter who wanted to interview her, and they really wanted her to tell how good the good old days were, and she didn't have a lot to say about how good the good old days were. But when they got to the subject of Carrie McGavick, this woman had been her mistress, her owner, later her employer. What Mariah could say about her, she said, no woman's ever had a better friend. She cut through it. I think that that's how she perceived the world. I also based her a bit on a maid of my grandmother's named Minnie Nichols, who pretty much ran the roost, who if you fell out with her, you fell out with my grandmother. My grandmother would trade her any day over her grandchildren as far as loyalty. And you know, Minnie had so little at the end of her life. I guess when I became aware of these kind of things and social issues, how little she had. And yet I will say that she would have been confused if you had tried to talk to her about that. I mean, her life was, as far as she saw it, was full and rich and happy and good. And this, she was no, Uncle Tom. She transcended her circumstances.
Listen, my family didn't get here until the 20th century. So, you know, the idea of the relationship of white people to the slaves and former slaves in the South has always been a mystery to me, and I think even in the South it's a mystery to them.
I think it is. And yet I grew up with it, and it's you cannot, you can't make it into a stereotype where people were happy, and yet I can give you case after case where I think people weren't, you know, just swallowing it, but were, you know, that the world worked for them.
Only have a couple of minutes left. We've got to talk about Zachariah Cashwell.
Okay.
Zachariah is a wounded soldier, a Confederate soldier.
Yes.
He's been severely, morbidly wounded in the leg.
Yeah.
Tell us about Zachariah.
Zachariah Cashwell is from Arkansas. He's really based on a boy that did come to the house and hardly ever left. Finally had to be taken away. He is part of that transformation of Carrie McGavick's life. He is from a very opposite world from her. The United States at that time was a very small place. The South was a smaller place, but it was a very stratified place. And he, being very different not only socially, but in the fact that he is willing to die and that he is ready to die. Carrie being very different, not only socially, but in the fact that she is morbidly obsessed with death and fearful of it. They meet and they transform each other's lives forever.
Now, is that something you cleverly did as a novelist, or is there some evidence about that?
A little bit of both, hopefully. Cleverly. I hope that's the right word. I needed a way to show how she became who she is. As I said, I know a lot about Carrie McGavick, but I don't know what her motivations are. And so,
Did she leave diaries or anything?
No,
like that?
And I think she would have considered it too frivolous. Mm-hmm. You know, she carried until the day she died. In fact, we still have it at Carton, her cemetery book, with the names of every boy that she could identify and in every grave in that cemetery. But I think she would have considered the idea of a diary way, way too frivolous for her.
You know, the phrase magnificent obsession has been beaten into a cliche, but it appears that it's absolutely true about her.
You know what? It worked for her, and she became a pilgrimage point for people both north and south. You know, we as Southerners are often buffooned about our ability not to forget. You know, as I say,
the past is not even past.
Yeah, the losers always remember. You know, nobody in London cares about Scottish nationalism, but go in a pub in Glasgow and talk about it. You know, but that said, there, you know, every monument in the South says those three words, lest we forget. But those of us who survived 9/11, those of us who recently survived these hurricanes, maybe we have an understanding, a little bit of an understanding of why these people shouldn't be forgotten. And that's what Carrie McGavick was about, not forgetting.
When I moved to Virginia, I was astounded to see that any town of any size in Virginia has a Confederate monument.
Right.
And it's usually Confederate soldiers standing at the top of the monument, always facing south.
Always facing with his back to the north. You're exactly right.
Yeah. And this every little thing is named after Lee, and it's... The Civil War is not even past.
No, it isn't. It isn't past. And again, remember, we lost. Remember that there were 620,000 deaths, and that the majority of them were in the South. You know, it's think about 9/11. When do we want to completely forget about it? You know, and then put it in proportion with the Civil War. You know, it probably is good for a few more centuries. I do want to go to Vermont. I hear in Vermont there is one town that has a Confederate monument. Now, by the way, there are Union monuments in the South. There are a lot of states and a lot of counties that supported the Union. So you do find squares that have Union monuments. But in Vermont, there is actually a town that has a Confederate monument. I don't know what it is, but I want to find it someday.
Is there a Union monument in Andersonville where the prison was?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yeah, I thought that might be. This, I could probably go on talking to you for another hour or so, but we don't have the time. I'd like to remind our listeners, I've been speaking with Robert Hicks, the author of The Widow of the South, published by Warner Books. What do you got in the fire? We only have a few seconds.
I'm working on, that's what I was doing right before I walked in here. I was talking to my editor. I'm working on the outline for a new book.
Well, when your book is published, come back and see us.
I love Portland. I'd love to come back.
Sure. Thank you.
Covers has been made possible in part by Foundation members and a grant from St. John's Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore, offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard in St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032.